What I'd like to do, first of all, is to... I'm deliberately sat in the middle here, you know? And I'm bigger than either of them. I'm not taller than Matt, but I'm heavier than him.
Apparently he's good at boxing.
Yeah, Jarrah. Yeah. I'll tell you a few stories about Jarrah and boxing, but anyway, what I'd like to do, because Matt's just been speaking, so we'll let him have a wee rest for a minute. And I know Kevin was making various notes there, so no doubt there are some issues that occur to you to speak to now, Kevin, and then we'll let Matt have another go, and then we'll open up the questions and answers.
Okay. Well, of course, I'm not a journalist, so I can't talk in that same polemical style. So what I say is probably less interesting to listen to, but I would argue it's got some more substance to it. A lot of things that put up at the end there, I mean, they put up the straw men, and I never thought we'd run out of order, or industry for years. A lot of these things, I don't think less of a layer would actually spread. Lots of people who work on climate science do not, you know, would agree with Matt on all those things. That doesn't mean to say, of course, that we, other parts of our views are necessarily wrong. So I think we completely overegg what it is that we see as a polarised argument, what the other side are actually saying. Now, I would take exception to some of your science graphs, some of you looking up the numbers, but I'm happy to accept some of the ways, and the same way you have to accept some of the emissions data that I was talking about. All I'll say is that there are lots of scientists who take a different interpretation of what you're saying there. So that we as the public, we have to judge where to go on that, and that may well be from a prudent approach. We would think something must be in between those, or with a more inside caution. My big concern is that you did exactly what the scientists do. You said nothing about emissions, and that is the problem with all the scientists, and it's a problem with the polemical skeptics of this issue. Is that they don't talk about emissions. Emissions is a nice curve in the absolute emissions with PPMV, the parts per million by volume, and its climate sensitivity. Well, that's not going to happen. 550 parts per million is the Harry Potter land of the emissions that go in the atmosphere. We're going to be way above that, and particularly burn all the oil and gas that you say is out there, which I fully agree is out there, and we are very likely to burn it. And so I think we'll burn this stuff out there, we'll go way above the concentrations you're talking about, and then there's an inconsistency in the argument, because if we do go above the concentrations, the temperatures we see are not the 1.2 you're talking about. It could be two or three times your 1.2. Let's assume your climate sensitivity is right, and certainly it's on the very low end of the spectrum. If the emissions go to 1,000 ppsv, which doesn't seem to me at all unreasonable to burn the stuff you keep telling us in the ground, and I agree with you, then we're talking about 1,000 ppmv. Then we're talking about much higher temperatures. So my temperatures, if you refer to related to climate sensitivity, are not related to the emissions and the climate sensitivity. And I don't think you tackle the emission issue at all. And when you did, if it was related to the supply side only, I mean, I won't go into that in detail, but I mean, I think most of that was just nonsense, I think, the death of the birds. These things do occur. Wind turbines are very destructive, but so are open cast pits. How many birds, how many eagles are killed in the open cast pits of other parts of the world? Do we know? No, we don't. And therefore, why?
Are they?
How many are they? 24, you mentioned the other one. So
that's one wind farm. Yeah, 23 golden eagles a year on average.
How many of Venezuelan mines?
I don't know.
I'll tell you,
because in a couple of years ago, one of the oil companies was prosecuted for drowning two birds.
Right.
In North America.
I would.
We know how many birds were killed we've got an estimate of how many birds were killed in the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico last year. It's smaller than the number killed by winter.
When I worked offshore on the oil rigs, we were given dispensations with a problem with our compressors to flare. So we were flaring a higher energy value than the size of a B nuclear power station. We flared it for 6 months, we were offshore. But a load of birds came into this repeatedly, attracted to it, because it was a very bright light, and they just circled around it, and every bird died. Because they kept trying to get near and near the light, and they would ignite, and we sat by and watched them. All offshore, all in the oil industry, and more than 24 of them. Now what I'm saying is that the oil industry, we're talking about thousands of birds here. The oil industry has been doing this, as of all energy systems, have been doing this for many, many years. Let's not try and take 24 birds there, or 3 birds there. Let's be more reasoned and make comparisons across these energy systems. And ultimately, if we don't consume energy, which you didn't mention at all, in terms of the demand side, which is where my focus was, if you don't consume energy, you don't have the birds dying either with wind turbines or the coal-fired power stations.
So you've conceded that there are big environmental problems about renewable technology.
I've never conceded. I've always taken that view.
So remember,
it's polemic. Polemic's not your way.
Okay, let's just throw a few numbers out there. What is the proportion of the total carbon dioxide going into the atmosphere every year that comes from industry?
From the whole globe.
The total flow of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere is 3%. About 97% comes from the biosphere.
No, that's not true. No, about 7% goes in, about 3% stays. Let's get the numbers right. Yeah, about 50% there.
No, it's not. It's, but the numbers I've seen, it's about
3%. No, 3% stays in. 7%
goes in. 3% emissions. Our emissions are 3% of
the carbon dioxide. Anyway, what we're saying, we're both agreeing, really. The amount of carbon dioxide we've got in the atmosphere is a very small proportion of the natural flows, and that's perfectly correct.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, what if we can find ways of bumping up natural absorption of carbon dioxide, then we could have a big impact, even if it's an incremental improvement. Yeah. So, for example, by improving the fertility of crops, etc., we can start to have effects like that by improving soils, etc., etc. Here's another one. If we increase carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere by 300 parts per million, what is the increase in the yields of crops, rice, wheat, and maize? With wheat, it's up to 40%. With maize, it's about 20%. With rice, it's about 30%. These are huge improvements that are already happening in yield. Now, that means that because we can grow more per acre and use less water and everything, we take slightly more pressure off the rainforest, etc. So, I'm not saying all effects of carbon dioxide are good, but I'm saying there are benefits as well as disadvantages.
We have to be quite careful, as you rightly point out, if the carbon dioxide goes up, the carbon dioxide is really important to grow plants. It's effectively, if we have more carbon dioxide, we'll get some improvement in the yields. You only get the improvement in the yields generally if you put a lot more fertiliser on. Fertiliser is a very major issue in terms of climate change as a greenhouse gas impact on the N2O, the gas that comes off it. So you would only get the yields if, and this is pretty much by and large across the planet, if you significantly increase your fertiliser that goes on there. So it's not saying you won't see some increase in yields, and actually when you get the PPNBs going higher, the yields start to drop again. And that comes back to the point about the emissions, and why did your curves only have 5 different parts per million? We've fallen into the trap with the scientists.
No, because that's the sensitivity of the atmosphere is always defined in terms of a W. So that's why my curves.
No, but you said that at the end of the century.
No, I said towards the end of the century.
Yeah, but we're going to hit those numbers way before the end of the century. We carry on doing what we're doing now.
Our technologies will stand still between now and then. And if you look at the effect of, if we are entering a period of huge amounts of gas being used at the expense of coal.
No, not at the expense.
It is going to rise. Check what's happening to coal mines and coal-fired power stations in America. They're closing.
The American ones are closing. You're quite right. Again, let's take a slightly more nuanced view of this. What's happened to the export market? The export market for coal is going up significantly. They're probably going to go from the fourth biggest export of coal to the third biggest export of coal. So the Americans are not actually reducing the amount of coal they're consuming. Let me finish this. It's a very important point in this. They're not reducing the amount of coal they're consuming. What can happen is their energy consumption is going up and it's being met by gas, as you might be pointing out, and gas is much lower carbon than coal. They are then exporting the coal to the energy-hungry parts of the world, in some parts, some hemisphere, principally. So there is no reduction in the level of coal that's being burned. We're burning the coal and we're burning the gas. So your substitution argument is completely flawed.
I think you need to take a more nuanced view of this, Kevin, because what you need to remember is that this shale gas is not just found in North America, it's found all around the world. Soon China's going to be producing shale gas, soon South America, South Africa, all these places, probably not Europe because we're so NIMBY about it, but all around the world you are going to get a huge substitution of gas. Now once...
Why substitution? Why
substitution? Because it's cheaper. Because it's so much cheaper. Because it is going to take market share from coal. Now, coal might yet grow if we get economic growth, but there is going to be a general
If you go to China,
because what you're implying is that if coal's going up, there's no substitution. That's not necessarily true.
They burn coal and gas.
They will indeed, but they'll burn more and more gas and
less coal. You're almost chipping over yourself there. they will not burn less coal, they will burn more coal. The Chinese energy system at the moment is suffering from lots and lots of blackouts or brownouts as well, because it cannot actually provide the energy it requires. They will use all the shale gas they can lay their hands on, they will use all the nuclear they can lay their hands on, they will use all the wind they can lay their hands on, they will have wind turbines, faster than the rest of the world put together at the moment. They also burn the nuclear, and they burn coal, and they use shale. Well, it is an and, not a substitution. And the climate doesn't give a damn whether the CO2 doesn't burn. Shale gas, from the power station, it only cares about the total quantity. So let's get away from this mythical view of substitution. The climate sees the absolute emissions. It's the sum of them, not the substitution impact. That's dangerous to take that.
I mean, I think that there is actually a point of agreement between Kevin and me, you may be surprised to hear, which is that the only way we can cut emissions significantly in the short term. Give us a century and we'll get fusion power or something that'll make it much easier, which is why I don't talk about 1,000 parts per million, by the way. I was trying to get to that point and never got
fusion
to
be there.
Yeah, it hasn't arrived yet.
Yeah,
but the only way we're going to drastically cut emissions in the short term is by shutting down civilization and driving people back into total poverty. And that's essentially what your charts are showing.
Well, but tell you one thing, that must be me, because I've actually reduced my emissions by about 90% in the last 10 years. Now, maybe I am a really good example of actually someone who's completely uncivilized, and I live a complete life of poverty. So I just think you only require a science, fortunately, one example to disprove your theory, and that I think I alone would disprove your theory. My emissions are still far too high, but I've made a dramatic reduction in my emissions, and I don't feel particularly. That have gone down in some sort of civilization.
Most emissions, for example, you mentioned fertilizer for farming. If we were trying to feed the current world population of 7 billion people with the average yields of the 1950s, when most farming was organic, when relatively little fertilizer was used around the world, it was used in Western countries but not much elsewhere, we would need 82% of the land area of the continents to be cultivated. Or farm. At the moment, we cultivate 38%. So thank God for fertilizer created by natural gas.
I'm not saying
because it. Give me a chance to finish one.
I'm not saying.
Thank God for fertilizer created by natural gas, which has enabled us to take the pressure off the rainforest and cut and raise the living standards of people. Reduce food per capita has gone up in every continent in my lifetime. Child mortality is down by 2/3. Life expectancy is up by 1/3 globally. These are wonderful achievements for humanity. A huge proportion of that comes from the availability of cheap energy from fossil fuels. If we tried to produce that by renewables, we would have done far more harm to the environment than we have done. And that, I think, is a point that you're saying the government needs to take on board.
But
it's possible that in the future we could actually
possibly
increase yields so much that we actually feed 9 billion people from a smaller acreage than we feed 7 billion from today, with the result that we can increase the amount of rainforest. All of these advantages of fossil fuels, which have been accruing to humanity for 200 years since we started using them in this very region, are not to be sniffed at. Now,
you're saying
that at a certain point, and you seem to agree it's not 500 parts per million, we're going to start to see damaging effects on the climate from carbon emissions. If you flew from here to New York,
don't worry.
If you flew from here to New York, and that distance was the total atmosphere, if you see what I mean, then the proportion of the atmosphere that is carbon dioxide would be the length of the runway. So when we're talking about going up to 300, 400, 500 parts per million, these are very small increases in terms of the total atmosphere. As I've shown you, the sensitivity of the atmosphere to carbon dioxide increases is pretty small.